Thank you for listening to the serialized podcast version of The Mark of a Druid, a fiction fantasy novel written and read by Rhonda R. Carpenter. I suggest that you start the story at the beginning, and to be sure that you get all of the episodes, go to themarkofadruid.com or rhondacarpenter.com. Episode 5. Chapter 6. The Gray Savior. After dashing out the front door, Ryerson traveled well above the speed limit to his office. He parallel parked his car in front of the brownstone where Ryerson Partners housed the development and administrative offices. He was late, for the third time this month.
"This is becoming a problem,"
he thought, running through the front door of the building. Sandy Chapman Cooper, as she liked to be called, was standing in front of her desk. She held in her left hand a leather binder, which Ryerson snatched. Her right hand grabbed the handle of the satchel before it hit the tan Berber carpeting. He shrugged off his jacket and handed it to Sandy.
"Craig's inside with the bloke from Los Angeles."
"How long?"
"Near on 15 minutes now, I told him. You were running a smidge behind schedule. Better get in there."
The corners of Sandy's lips lifted on one side and lowered on the other, giving her the look of a disapproving mother. Her hair was pulled back into a ponytail. Her cinnamon-colored eyes were alight with a mischievous glint as she placed her free hand on his shoulder and shoved him toward the double doors.
"Go on, then," Sandy said.
He took the empty chair next to his partner, Craig Bellamy. R.J. Rolfing was seated across the oval-shaped oak table from Craig, who looked up when Ryerson came in. The conference room walls closed in on him.
"I'm very sorry for being held up."
Ryerson reached across the table and shook hands with R.J.
"Not a problem. We were just talking about the trip to the States," said R.J.,
obviously none too affected by Ryerson's late arrival. "You look like you've had a bit of a rough night, old man." Craig looked Ryerson over, inspecting him with a sympathetic smile that told Ryerson at once this had not been the day to be late.
"I'll tell you all about it later. Shall we get started?"
Ryerson could feel the heat of a blush forming just under his collar. This was the last meeting they would have before RJ left for the United States. Spec sheets were quickly opened and spread about the table, and the three men reviewed the product revisions that had occurred since their last meeting. With all the technical details out of the way, Craig handed out the latest production reports.
"These production numbers will never hold up in the open market. Without this merger, you'll be unable to meet demand within 6 months.
RJ's brows creased into a single line, which ran the width of his forehead, capping his thick, dark brown eyes.
"This is good timing, gentlemen. The merger will save you the trouble of overseeing production and distribution. You'll both be able to focus on development, and we know that's where you should be. This software is going to revolutionize internet communications, however. Like I said before, the board will want at least one of you to stay on until quality control and production are in place."
RJ leaned back in his chair, stretching his arms over his head, letting them rest intertwined at the base of his skull. A broad smile crossed his face. It disappeared when he saw that the lead on this endeavor, Ryerson, was not paying attention once again. Craig jumped in, sitting forward, and kicked Ryerson under the table.
"You're right. This is perfect timing. And as long as the numbers are acceptable, I think we'll have a deal."
"I agree."
Ryerson rubbed his shin casually. "I think we'll be able to benefit from our ongoing relationship, RJ."
Then he shot a glare to Craig. RJ unfolded his 6-foot frame from the chair, tugged his black cashmere jacket into place, and buttoned the double-breasted front with an effortless grace.
"I'll see you both at the airport in L.A. a week from Thursday."
He shook their hands, and Craig walked him out of the room. Ryerson stood at the end of the conference table rolling spec sheets. Then he placed double rubber bands around them. When he returned, Craig took the scrolls and stepped outside, handing them off to Sandy. Ryerson didn't even notice when he came back again. He was off inside his own mind. Craig placed his hand on Ryerson's shoulder.
"Where the bloody hell were you this morning?"
"Rye."
He gave the shoulder a shake.
"What?"
What's going on with you?
You're a quarter of an hour late for a very important meeting, and when you get here, well, you're not really here.
I've not been sleeping well. Been having some of the strangest dreams. I mean, I'm taking the day off.
Ryerson turned and walked out of the room. He grabbed his briefcase and made for the door. Sandy handed Ryerson his jacket. He pulled, but she didn't release it. She held his stare. His eyes were glazed.
Ryerson, are you running a fever?
She released her hold on the jacket and reached to touch his forehead. Ryerson scowled while he pulled back.
Taking the day off. Don't call me.
He uttered the words flatly and walked past her. She stared, flabbergasted.
Fine, take off then. Go on.
Craig bellowed from the other room.
I'll handle it all. Don't worry yourself over us. We'll be fine. Same to you with brass knobs.
Ryerson closed the door with a controlled click. Ryerson Sanders found himself standing at the edge of a circle of stones. At the pit of his stomach, a gnawing twinge of uncertainty lingered. It was late afternoon, that much was apparent. The last thing he truly remembered was ending the business meeting and pissing Craig off. His brown loafers were caked with mud. His khaki pants were grass and mud-stained. He took a physical inventory. He wiggled his fingers, stretched his wrists, then flexed his elbows, extending his arms up over his head. In an attempt to be sure he was not dreaming, he even pinched himself.
How the bloody hell did I get here?
He mumbled, staring into the trees. The forest around him was dense with undergrowth. The trees were thick with foliage, ranging in color from a tender pale green to the deeper shades of emerald and hunter. He scanned the area, turning a full 360 degrees. Ryerson was completely and utterly alone. He saw no trail leading to the circle of stones. The sky overhead was heavy with its burden of water, gray, billowing clouds, backlit by an unseen sun, moved rapidly across the sky. The forest that surrounded him seemed to have eyes of its own. Or maybe it was just his imagination. He stepped fully into the center of the ancient circle. This obviously was not one of the tourist hinges. Tall grass separated each of the seven outer stones, all of which reached well past his knees. Moss covered the north sides of the massive monolith. The ground sank beneath his weight when he stepped into the center of the hinge. The feeling of concealed eyes swept over him like an invisible vortex sucking at his consciousness. It sent a shiver down his spine and made the hair on the back of his neck and forearms stand at attention. He peered into the forest, vainly seeking for what was watching him. Thunder rolled overhead, giving its warning of the torrential rains that were about to soak him mercilessly. The air was charged with static electricity. Or maybe it was just his fear that charged his environment. The mist hung heavily in the air, seeming to increase its density with each passing moment. Ryerson had no idea how he was going to find his way out of this place. He didn't remember driving his car here, or even if it was somewhere close. The lapse in time and memory rocked his very foundation. He stepped toward the northernmost stone and placed his hands upon its rough, pitted surface. The stone held a vibration of its own, a low, droning hum that pulsated through the palms of his hands. Ryerson's heart pounded so strongly inside his chest, he felt it might escape its cage of bone and muscle. He held tighter to the surface of the rock. It felt as if an eternity passed while he fought to stop his knees from buckling. He was so engrossed in maintaining his standing position that he almost missed the movement in the trees to his right. He swung his gaze toward it. With hesitant steps, a large gray wolf paced just at the edge of the tree line. Seconds turned into minutes. Time passed in a standoff of wills. He cautiously stepped behind the stone, placing the only object of protection at his disposal between him and this wild animal. The wolf never took his eyes off Ryerson's slow, calculated movements. The wolf made no move to come closer, and Ryerson made no move to flee. Maybe I should run, he thought, but he knew there was no chance he could outrun this carnivore. The next action, Ryerson decided, was up to the wolf. A sudden sweeping fog quickly destroyed all line of sight. The only thing visible to Ryerson was the stone upon which his hands rested. The wolf was hidden from his sight. What did he know about wolves? He searched his memory. He knew wolves traveled in packs. It occurred to him that there were no wolves in Wales. He knew that wolves had been hunted to extinction on the whole of the island. Thunder crackled in the sky. Lightning struck somewhere in the distance. Ryerson waited, unsure of what to do. The rain began to fall gently at first, and then increased until each drop stung his unprotected skin. The rain pounded the fog into submission, scattering its gloomy essence into oblivion. His dark black hair dripped around his ears. He wiped his eyes with the backs of his hands. The wolf was a hair's breadth away from him. When he opened his eyes again, Ryerson froze. His heart raced. He needed to run, but his feet remained firmly planted. The animal made no aggressive moves, lifting its upturned muzzle into the air and inclining its neck. The wolf sniffed at Ryerson's hand. Warm, moist air passed over Ryerson's fingertips, and he willed himself to stand still. He did not make a move, not even to breathe. The wolf gently placed its cold nose into the palm of Ryerson's hand, inhaling deeply. With the bridge of its long nose, it lifted Ryerson's hand and tossed its head. First, Ryerson felt the coarse hair slip between his fingers and come to rest on the fur-covered cartilage of the wolf's ear. Suddenly, there was no fear, but a strange sense of kinship, which he didn't fully understand. The wolf moved very slowly, allowing Ryerson's hand to glide along its back until all that was beneath Ryerson's palm was the tip of its tail. His hand fell to his side with measurably deliberate motion. He watched the wolf trot toward the forest edge. Just as it was about to enter the trees, the wolf turned, looked back at Ryerson, and gave a low whine. The animal moved forward 20 paces or so before once again, looking to be sure Ryerson followed. He couldn't believe this was happening. Hallucination or not, this wolf wanted something. It was leading him. Every muscle in Ryerson's body obeyed when his mind commanded him to follow the wolf. It made the way through the forest at a trot as it leaped over fallen logs and rocks. The animal moved deliberately through the trees. Right for 30 or 40 paces, left for about 15 minutes, Ryerson guessed, until it stopped abruptly. The forest thinned, and Ryerson could see his car parked at the side of the roadway. Jerking its head to the car and back to Ryerson, the wolf turned to face the man. Ryerson looked on the animal with a sense of amazement. It was obvious this was no ordinary wolf. Lowering himself to his knees, Ryerson offered his hand in thanks. He hoped the wolf wouldn't bite it off. The wolf slipped his hand under Ryerson's head, allowing him to stroke his body, nose to tail. Then it turned and walked the other way. Ryerson rose from his knees, and the rain continued to pelt his already shivering, drenched body. The downfall splattered to the ground, flinging tiny droplets of mud onto the hem of Ryerson's pants. The window was down in his car. Water had soaked the interior's upholstery, causing a puddle to form on the floorboard. He reached into the puddle and extracted his keys, shook them off, and climbed into the car. The road was empty. The saturated seat released cold water into Ryerson's pants and shirt. He started the engine. He rolled up the window, astonished that the car was even there. The dashboard clock had fogged up. He tapped it with his right index finger, and a large drop of condensation formed, slid down the face of the glass, and found its way to the edges. The time read 5:15 p.m. Chapter 7. A Cycle Completes. Eve's lids fluttered and closed. She sank into a swirling tunnel of color and light. A single crimson beam flooded her vision, then settled around her as she melted into it. Four-year-old Alian sat on the dirt floor, her eyes glued on her mother, waddling from place to place as she prepped the evening meal. A huge cauldron was suspended over the central fire. Aroke added some of the herbs that Alian had helped pick yesterday. Her bright red smock was covered with many pockets and hung over her large belly. Alian watched her mother as she turned and smiled and said, "Alian, bring me the water from the table." Short, stout legs carried the child easily from her spot on the dirt floor. Alian lifted the small leather water pouch from the table. Aroke made a clicking noise as she looked down at her child. "Hold still. You look like you've been eating with the cows, and your father returns soon." She wiped Alian's face with a damp cloth. Aroke fussed over the child's tangled hair, trying in vain to place the wild curls into some kind of order. The young, chubby girl with the dirt-stained face had a head full of golden-red curls and big, doe-shaped eyes of emerald green. She made funny faces as she was wiped clean. "Today, there may be a celebration." "What kind, Mama?" "You will no longer be my only child. You know I have your sister growing in my belly, and the gods have told me that you will meet her this night." Aroke took Alian's hands and laid them on her stomach, as she had for months now. Something inside pushed straight out. She giggled at the baby's movements. She looked at where her hands had been. The lump in her mother's tummy roiled in all directions.
"Are you sure that's her?"
Aroke nodded and tapped Alian on the shoulder. "Yes, that is her, and she will see you soon." Aroke plucked at Alian's nose. "Always remember this. Alian, the life that grows inside a woman is sacred. Your sister began of the love I share for Knut, and the request you made for a sister."
"I did that?"
The child gaped at her mother's stomach as it heaved and stretched out of proportion. "When you asked the gods for a gift like this," she said, rubbing her hand in a circular motion over the unseen child, "the gift always comes with a price. Not all of our decisions in life are of our own making." Alian stared up at her mother's clear blue eyes. The light from the fire flickered and danced in their depths. The heat was warm on the child's cheeks.
"Mama, will the baby have the mark too?"
"No, I think not, Alian. Her path is not the same as yours, although the two of you will walk together for a time. You have much to learn of the mark, and when it is time, O Great One, you will be told what it means. Now go and get your father's cup. Place it on the table. He arrives shortly." Aroke began to sing in her light, soft, high voice, as she often did, making up songs about Alian. The little girl loved the way her mother softly cooed of the great life she would have as a druidess in the clan of the Standing Stones. "Alian of the red hair, I hold you so dear. You came to me, bringing me cheer. Alian of the mark, it ties you to a new land. Seek its shores with the help of a man. More help you will find in the gods of our time. Alian, pick up the cup, and you will find your father is home right on time." They laughed as the door opened, and Knut stepped inside. A towering man, he stood 6'4" tall, with white blonde hair that fell about his shoulders. He placed his sword and shield on the wall. Aroke poured mead into his horned cup. Alian ran into his strong arms. He lifted her off the ground and tossed her into the air. "Alian of the red hair, you have grown since I left this morn." Unable to hold the news, the child squealed with excitement. "Father, father, I'm going to be a sister tonight." Tossing Alian in the air again, he briefly looked toward Aroke. She stood holding an outstretched cup of mead and nodded to him.
his eyebrows furrowed, and a deep crease formed between his eyes. Aroque spoke in a soft, reassuring voice. "Do not worry. All will be as it should be, my husband." He placed Alian on the floor and took Aroque into his arms and kissed her. Alian grew tired of waiting. It seemed to her that the kiss lasted a very long time. The youngster tugged at his breeches. Kanut lifted her into his arms and placed her between he and Aroque. They hugged, and Alian giggled. After the evening meal, Aroque suddenly grabbed the table. Alian saw the grimace of pain on her mother's face. Aroque's knuckles went white as she tightened her grip on the table. She looked at Kanut and asked him to open the door. Orion was outside on his perch. Aroque held out her arm, and the raven flew to her in a rush of wing-swept wind. She leaned down to him, stroked his shiny black feathers, and cooed. In a swift movement, she dropped her arm slightly and raised it. The raven spread his wings and flew out the door. Soon, Dubjila, a healer from the wood, arrived, and behind her, the raven, Orion, swooped down from the sky. Black wings spread wide. He landed lightly behind the healer, settling himself in a ruffle of feathers on the perch outside the door, and cried at the sky. The woman glanced from one to the other and then to Kanut. With the unspoken request acknowledged, he stood and took Alian's hand. "You, child, will come with me," he said, taking the sword down from the wall. 4 steps to each one of his, Alian ran to keep hold of his hand. Winded and tired, she began to slow her pace, and he scooped her up into his arms. "Where do we go?" "I want to see my sister," she pouted. "Your sister must first be born, Alian, and that may take some time. We will go spread the news of her coming." Within a few long strides, they entered the large central hall of the village. He placed Alian on the ground. She did not come here often. Her attention focused on the bright-colored shields and animal skins that hung on the walls. Her father walked to the chair at the end of the long table and sat quietly. His forehead crease deepened with each passing hour. Several of the men from the village talked with Kanut. Sleepy and bored, Alian crawled into his lap. She snuggled close against his warm chest. She listened to the beating of his heart, steady and strong. The soft fur lining of his brat was warm against her little legs, but it tickled. The next time Alian's eyes opened, she was in her dwelling, and her mother was lying on the sleeping rack, motionless. Dubjila rushed her helpers out of the room. Alian thought her mother was sleeping, but she could not understand how anyone could sleep with all that crying. A wailing that seemed unending came from the small bundle her father held. Tears welled in his eyes. "Is that my sister?" A yawn escaped the child's lips, and she sat up from the straw mattress that was her bed. Alian rubbed the backs of her hands across sleepy eyes and yawned again. Dubjila washed off Aroque's face as Kanut lay the screaming, squirming infant into Alian's lap. It did not much look like what she thought a sister would look like. The baby was red and wrinkled with not a hair on its head. She had even smaller fingers than Alian, and each one had a tiny little nail. Kanut moved to Aroque's side, knelt down, then kissed her lightly on the cheek. Tears streamed down his face. Alian could not remember ever seeing her father cry. It frightened her. She strained to listen to what he was saying to her mother.
"Aroque, please don't leave me.
I need you. To warm my bed. To tend the children.
Don't leave me. I cannot face life alone.
His voice trailed off into a sob, and Aroque's hand came to rest on his tear-stained cheek. Stroking the tears away, she shushed him and tried to speak.
"Husband, friend, protector, you will do what must be done. Come closer."
He leaned in toward her, and she whispered in his ear. The only thing Alian heard clearly was,
"When the time comes, you must cut yourself off from..."
"Of the three I love, I am to have one.
Only one?"
As Aroque turned her head, she saw her eldest child watching, and said in a strained voice, "Alian, of the red hair? You, her breath came in ragged gasp, you will tend your sister. And Abdila will tend you. Alian moved closer. When the time comes, you will leave this place. The breath gave way, and after long moments, she finished. And fulfill your birthright. Do you understand, child? I will always love you as my very own. And I pledge to you that I will always be near. You need only call to me. Her air failed. Alian touched her mother's cheek and nodded, auburn curls bouncing about her face. Yes, Mama, I will. Dabjila took the newborn and held her skyward toward the thatched roof, as far as her arms would stretch. The healer sang in a low voice. This child has come. She must be named. This child has come. Your servant she shall be. This child has come. Dabjila's eyes were closed, and she swayed, holding the baby high overhead. Her song droned on and on. The baby's cries drowned out many of the words. Kanut still knelt alongside Arok. Finally, Dabjila lowered the child and said her name for the first time. The gods have chosen an old and honored name. This child is to be known as Athene, Speaker of the Truth. Her father turned and nodded. Her mother grabbed for his hand. Alian ran to her mother's side. She heard a sound she would never be able to forget. A deep, husky rattle came from her mother's throat. It came from deep inside. Then Arok stopped breathing. A long exhale left her mouth ever so slowly, and Alian watched her chest for breath. It did not come. Kanut fell to the floor. He pulled at his white blonde hair, beat his fists on the ground in a momentary lapse in his staunch composure. He raised himself after a few minutes. Alian looked into his steel blue eyes. They were glazed with tears. He pulled the child closer to him and said, Kiss your Arok goodbye. She is on her way to live with the gods, to dine at their table, to feast. This was the first of many changes in her father. The clear blue eyes of a warrior stared helplessly at Alian. Only a short time before, they had been fierce and cunning. Now they were clouded, dull, and hopeless. Alian leaned over her mother for the last time that night, as life completed a full revolution. The passing of Arok and the birth of her sister Athene marked a coming of age that Alian would later think arrived much too soon. However, in that moment, she knew no better than to do as she was told. She kissed her mother on the lips. For the first time, those lips did not kiss back. Dawn broke the horizon in a splash of fiery reds. Alian watched the druid death march ceremony for her mother. White robes billowed in the breeze. Arok's body was carried to the stone circle. A sprig of heather dangled in Alian's hand. In the center of the sacred circle, her body was laid on a slab of smooth bluestone. The clan of the Standing Stone gathered to sing her praises. Plain white-robed men and women called to the gods and goddesses in harmonious voices. Their hair was plaited and tied with bits of ribbon and vine. Kanut was stoic and proud as he stood by his wife's dead body. The clan danced and chanted in the ancient ways. The healers entered the circle. Alian of the Red Hair, intoned the high druid from another clan. Arthfiel stood robed and hooded against a blazing sky. The shadowy stones of the circle consumed and deflected the sun's rays. Alian stared at this man's gray eyes, which twinkled from beneath his hood as it fell back. His head was shaved in a tonsure, giving him the appearance of an extremely high forehead. On his chest lay a bronze medallion. interlacing knots surrounding its edges. In the center, a raised symbol gleamed. Arthviel touched the medallion, almost caressing it as he spoke. His voice seemed to thunder and bounce off the stones, ricocheting from ear to ear.
The gods have opened their arms to Arok of the White Hair, Druidess of the Standing Stones. Before your sister crosses into the veil, Alian of the Red Hair will be joined to her spirit. Step forward, child.
Alian did not understand what he meant, but with Dubjila's insistent hand on the small of her back, she stepped forward. Arthviel took the child's hand, holding it palm up. Dubjila sliced a thin scratch along the child's lifeline. Alian tried to pull away, but Dubjila calmed her with a firm hand on her shoulder and a stern look that said this was important. The healer repeated the cut, but this time on Arok's hand. Alian cried silently. Arthviel joined the palms of the woman and the child, the living and the dead, holding them firmly in place. A fine, thin cloth shimmered iridescently while being wrapped around the joined hands, preventing separation. Then Arok's body was covered in a sheer white fabric, the likes of which Alian had never seen. Arthviel leaned down and whispered to Alian,
"Now, child, give Arok a gift to seal the exchange."
The young child placed the sprig of heather in the binding of her shroud. A rush of energy entered Alian's body. Her shoulders convulsed. Tears fell like rain. Eve sat up in bed. The tears streamed hot and salty down her face. She threw back the covers, waking Kaz from a cat's deep sleep. Swinging her feet off the bedside, she trudged to the bathroom. An overwhelming sadness threatened to break her heart. The tears were not for herself, but for the child in the dream. Eve looked in the mirror and gazed off into the depths of her dark green eyes. It felt as if it were me. As if I was the child. Sweet Jesus, what's happening to me? I feel like I'm going crazy. Eve scraped her fingernails over her scalp. In the kitchen, she ran the tap and reached for a glass from the oak cabinet. Kaz squalled his disapproval. She imagined he was telling her to go back to bed, but he paced in front of the armoire that held the stereo equipment. "Cut it out, Kaz. You're acting so weird." On her way back upstairs, Eve grabbed her journal. She sat, knees drawn up to her chest, in the middle of the queen-size bed. Kaz coiled himself into a ball of fawn-colored fur at her feet. She wrote what she remembered of the dream. She hoped that by putting the words to the page, she could save herself the vivid pain of loss. If not, she would pull it apart, dissect it, like a frog in a 10th-grade science class. Hadn't she lost enough in her life? She wondered. Both parents killed in a car accident. Her closest relative, a grandmother, had raised her and died of a stroke 2 years before. Lonely anger surrounded her. She wanted to know what it was all about, what all of these dreams meant. Eve laid the journal aside and glanced at the clock. 1:59 a.m. Scientific study was best done with a clear mind and a non-emotional attachment. Was she ready for that? Could she detach? She pulled the cat up to her chest and held him there. Stroking his head, he put two front paws into her hair and gently extended his claws. He pressed and squeezed repeatedly. His gentle massaging caused Eve to breathe a sigh of relief. The deep, muffled sound of his purring was a constant reminder she was not alone.
Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of The Mark of a Druid, and stop back again. Pick up the next episode at rondacarpenter.com or themarkofadruid.com. So until next time, thanks and take care.